This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about efforts to identify and fix problems with so-called forever chemicals, known as PFAS, in Rhinelander and elsewhere in the state. Now, after weeks of negotiations, a bipartisan Senate group finally reached a deal on its $1 trillion-ish infrastructure package. If passed, it would be one of the biggest infrastructure bills in U.S. history. It includes funding for clean drinking water initiatives, increasing public transit accessibility, making broadband internet universally available, roads, of course, and more. But it's not a done deal yet. The full Senate would have to approve it. Plus, there's the House. We're talking now about the fate of the trillion-dollar Senate infrastructure bill, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you see the biggest need for infrastructure improvement here in Wisconsin and in the country at large? What do you want to know about what's included in the bill? Do you want to see it passed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen Smith is a professor of political science and a distinguished professor of social sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back with you.
Before we start to look at the policy details in here, I want to ask you, is it worth taking a close look at the policy details? Is this a thing that you think might make it across the finish line?
Absolutely. The bipartisan deal seems like pretty much a slam dunk in the Senate. And I think the only question in the House is whether or not liberals will find voting on this before a larger package comes up to be a satisfactory arrangement. And so there's some serious question in the House, but there's enough support for it. It's just a matter of strategy there. I think we're going to see this bipartisan package adopted inside the month.
What do you see as some of the key elements here? The money's going a lot of different ways. What are the most important things that stand out to you?
This really is a big deal. There's, approaching $600 billion of new spending beyond what was already planned, which was already in the neighborhood of $500 billion on infrastructure in the federal budget. So this is a great expansion of federal funding for roads and bridges and mass transit, great improvements in the airports and ports, the first big federal investments in electric vehicle infrastructure. And there's some brand new things. The Texas power situation last year has led the federal government to want to invest big time in the power infrastructure, our so-called grid, electric grid, in order that really must be improved for us to move into renewables in a bigger way. A huge investment in broadband by creating large financial incentives for broadband service providers to move into areas that are poorly served at present. So it touches on a great number of things. Even it goes as far as to spend $21 billion on environmental remediation. Superfund and other related programs have been grossly underfunded in the view of environmentalists for a long time, and this provides a lot of catch-up money. So it's a big deal. It's not a minor consideration, and it's going to have a huge impact on the physical infrastructure of the country.
Did we need this kind of upgrade of our physical infrastructure? Every now and then we hear adjectives like crumbling or outdated or overdue repairs, things like that. Do we need something like this, do you think?
Well, it's kind of hard for us as regular people to know something about needs on this scale. Mm-hmm. But when you turn to something like the American Society of Civil Engineers, who keep track of the crumbling infrastructure, they would say this is just a small bite at a very, very, very much larger problem. But it's an important improvement. Most of us have some experience with declining roads and bridges. Most of us think that public transit in major cities hasn't really received a major investment in a very long time. Most of us even think that Amtrak has been grossly underfunded and that surface transportation between major cities really needs to be improved. So I think the need is real. And I think many people would argue that it actually grossly underfunds what's needed, even in physical infrastructure.
We're talking to political scientist Stephen Smith from Washington University, looking at an infrastructure deal in the Senate by a bipartisan group of senators that may actually pass after years of talk about some kind of infrastructure deal. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, hopes, fears, and or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, let's talk about how this is being paid for now. A lot of the COVID relief, there wasn't so much concern about pay-fors, but the negotiators here said, hey, we want to make sure that the money's coming from somewhere real. Democrats wanted to rescind the Trump-era tax cuts. Republicans didn't want that. Republicans said, hey, how about user fees? Democrats want that. The compromise, neither, as I'm understanding. Where are they finding the money then?
It's it's more than a dozen different little pots of money that they're either using an accounting, I don't want to say it's a gimmick, but money that's already been appropriated for other purposes is going to be repurposed for this. So as you say, they're going, the biggest single source of money is repurposing COVID relief funds that that have not gone to the states and local governments as originally planned months ago. But beyond that, there's a wide variety of changes. They're reinstating Superfund fees so that companies that are responsible for the ground pollution have to pay fees again. There's a variety of customs user fees that are going to be added that adds up to $5 or $6 billion. The number of items that are around $4, $5, $6 billion is actually pretty pretty large. Some of this is somewhat speculative, I must confess. For example, they throw in $50 billion just because they think that the spending is going to juice up the economy some, and that's going to lead to additional revenues, so-called dynamic scoring. But there's a little guesswork in that. That's not guaranteed. But it's been enough to persuade more than a dozen Republicans in the Senate that it's paid for. And from the Democrats' point of view, that's all they needed to do, is to persuade about that many Republicans that the money is there.
Is there something about infrastructure spending that makes it palatable for voters and constituents? It gives members of Congress something they can point to when they go back home?
Absolutely. It's something where, you know, every member of Congress can show up for a groundbreaking ceremony, for a new interchange on the freeway, for a new water or sewer plant, the kinds of things that everyone in a community benefits from. And the benefits are so wide. Big business benefits, because some of this money actually goes into the pockets of big business, which is constructing these projects. And so it's very easy for members of Congress to like this. For example, there's probably around $9 billion in this to improve Western water storage. Many Republicans are from the Plain States and Mountain West, where water storage is a pretty serious problem. And there's a big chunk of money going into improving those facilities, which have aged and are greatly in need of expansion, and especially with worries about new arid lands because of climate change, there's been great concern there. So all of those Republicans can go home and say that they were responsible for bringing this money back to their states. That helps get those votes for the bill.
Given that, why has it taken so long? I know some of the post great recession relief, early Obama administration, a lot of that was infrastructure-y. I think the Obama administration had talked about doing more. Definitely there was thought that the Trump administration and congressional Democrats could work together on infrastructure. Given the popularity, why did it take so long to get here?
Well, you probably remember that the White House, the Biden administration, proposed two additional plans after the COVID relief bill was passed. This one is called the Jobs Plan, and then there was one that we now are calling the Human Infrastructure Package. And Republicans had some interest in physical infrastructure, but they didn't approve of how much the Biden administration had proposed. So while there is about $600 billion of new spending in the bill the Senate's considering at the moment, the Biden administration had proposed, you know, more than double that. The Republicans said that was too rich. But if they were willing to, if the Biden administration was willing to consider something smaller, a bipartisan coalition might be possible. Well, the Biden White House took the lead on this and said, yeah, we're willing to cut a deal to get a bipartisan bill. But it proved to be really quite difficult to negotiate. Eventually, they came up with something. And in mid-July, they announced the broad outlines. And it's taken them 3 weeks to come to terms on the specifics. But that meant that the big chunks, especially on the human infrastructure side, were left untouched. And the Democrats, in the meantime, began to devise the plan to take that up in a separate bill, knowing that there wouldn't be any Republican support for it. In fact, there'd be a Republican filibuster of it in the Senate. The Democrats turned to the budget process, where they can use a process that we all know as reconciliation that allows the bill to come up, not be filibustered, and subject only to a simple majority vote. So the Democrats have been working on two tracks, and the details of that second track, that larger, really much larger human infrastructure bill, is likely to be over $3 trillion as opposed to $600 billion, are yet to be worked out. A general plan was announced in mid-July among Senate Democrats, the Senate Budget Committee Democrats, and the majority leader, Chuck Schumer from New York, announced that they had the outline of a general plan, but they have yet to act on that. And that would happen, according to Schumer, sometime soon after they pass this first smaller bipartisan plan on physical infrastructure.
Talking to Stephen Smith, professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis, talking about the agreement reached among a group of bipartisan senators on an infrastructure deal. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 based on what you've heard about it, read about it. You think it's a good bill, good government spending? What would you change about it, if anything? And do you want to see Democrats then pass the wider so-called human infrastructure bill down the road? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Stephen Smith, professor of political science at Washington University, talking about what's in the Senate's big infrastructure bill and the road ahead. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you want infrastructure money going in your community, in your state, around the country? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeremy is with us in Kenosha. Jeremy, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Jeremy?
I think the infrastructure money should be spent on bicycle infrastructure and mass transit, like light rail infrastructure, and that would help our obesity epidemic, reduce the amount of traffic that is around in city and suburbs. And I think that there's no end to the amount of road expansions and road repairs that are going to be needed if we don't do something about the amount of automotive traffic. So we have to make it a lot more attractive for cyclists, or else it's never going to happen.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. You mentioned earlier, Steve, some money going to Amtrak, some other mass transit programs. What else do we know about what's in this package when it comes to Jeremy's concerns?
Well, the kind of detail that Jeremy's asking for probably is not in the bill at all, but it certainly would be expected that states and localities that apply to the federal government for grants under these programs would seek to expand bicycle lanes and bicycle paths, and even make mass transit buses and so on more amenable to bike riders who want to take their bikes with them. There's also quite a bit of money for road safety, and bicycle safety is a part of federal policy on road safety. So I think we're likely to see an improvement there. But the balance of federal funding between support for roads and bridges on the one hand and public transit on the other is not changing much. Both are getting a huge dose of new investment. In fact, it's probably the single largest new investment in public transit that we've ever seen. So it might not be the right balance for Jeremy, but certainly we're going to see a lot more money spent on things that he's asking for.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Another funding area that we mentioned earlier that's we've talked a lot about here in Wisconsin is funding for broadband internet infrastructure. It's a big issue in rural parts of our state and sometimes not so rural parts of our state. How much of a focus is there on that high-speed internet access?
Well, it's spending like we've never seen before, at least out of the federal government. The plan calls for $65 billion to be spent on the extension of broadband services. Much of this will come in the form of incentives to broadband providers to move into difficult to reach areas, which, as you say, is largely rural areas where the cost of extending lines has been prohibitive for many of them. Many rural communities realize they're losing business because they can't get high-speed broadband for their small business or manufacturing plants locally. So this will be a big investment in broadband, and I think at $65 billion, the average state's going to get more. Just think, more than $1 billion per state. In broadband funding. That's a big increase in funding.
We're talking about infrastructure, a plan in the Senate, bipartisan support for it. Stephen Smith is with us, political science professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. Steve, I know you have a particular interest in how the Senate and the House hash out details with this plan. Supposing the Senate passes something, is it likely that the House is going to just vote up or down on what comes out of the Senate? Or are they going to do their own thing and then have to mesh it all together?
Well, the liberal Democrats, and in fact, most Democrats, simply want this physical infrastructure bill coming in at about $600 billion of new spending, or about $1 trillion total, to be paired with a larger $3.5 trillion bill that's now being called the human infrastructure bill. And Schumer says that the Senate will act to move forward on that second bill as soon as this bill is passed. In the House, Speaker Pelosi has said that the House Democrats will not act on the smaller physical infrastructure bill until the second one is completely through the Senate, which could take until sometime in the fall. That pits her against some of the moderates in her own party. The Blue Dog Coalition and a bipartisan group called the Problem Solvers Caucus leadership, and both groups have written the speaker asking that the smaller physical infrastructure bill receive a vote as soon as it comes over from the Senate. She says no. She says that we have to wait until the larger human infrastructure bill comes. She wants to hold out because she needs, she wants to continue to put pressure on Senate Democrats and some of those Senate Republicans to actually get action on this second bill. And she's backed by liberal Democrats, some of who say they would never vote for the smaller bill until the larger one is ready too. So the situation is really quite fluid in the House. It's not exactly clear how she will balance the liberal against moderate forces in her party over the timing of votes on these two packages. And of course, the second package isn't a sure bet in the Senate. It requires a majority. And we still have some moderate Democrats in the Senate, Manchin and Sinema most notably, who have said that the $3.5 trillion figure worked out between the leadership on the Democratic side of the Senate and the White House is too large. They'd like to see it reduced. And they need their votes. It's a 50-50 Senate. You can't lose any Democrats in order to get that bill through the Senate. So there's a lot of negotiating to go forward here. And August, usually a quiet month in Washington, may prove to be a loud and noisy month.
Time for one more caller. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is very complicated, but I want to say that there is a way to transmit power to vehicles in the roadway. Bordeaux, France has a trolley that runs around without a hot line or anything, no hot rail, so it's not dangerous, and it must do it by induction.
Tom, it sounds like too more complicated we get into in the last just a minute and a half we have, Steve, but a fundamental change in the way our road infrastructure works. How tough would that be to pull off?
Well, the thing that Tom is actually asking for is more research and development in this area. That kind of technology he's requesting is very expensive and could only be used in a very limited way, at least in the foreseeable future. But what's important about this physical infrastructure bill, and actually the second human infrastructure bill, is that both have quite a bit of money for research and development. And in the energy area in particular, there's billions now that are being included for additional research and development, both by the government itself and through grants to the private sector and university community. So this is not a bill, the physical infrastructure bill, that focuses on climate change. But in fact, the research and development is going to target energy technologies in an important way.
Tom, thanks for that call. Sorry we don't have time to do full justice to it, but Steve, you did a good job there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
That's Stephen Smith, professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He joined us for a look at the Senate infrastructure bill. Bipartisan group of senators have an agreement on it. Now it goes to the full Senate and then the House. Coming up, we learn the story of a Wisconsin city working with a team of UW-Madison researchers to better understand their problems with PFAS chemicals and how to try to tackle them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, we heard a story about La Crosse area residents who recently learned of PFAS contamination in their drinking water. But in the northeastern Wisconsin town of Peshtigo, people have been drinking bottled water for years because of PFAS pollution. The contamination there stems from the use of firefighting foam that contained PFAS at Tyco's fire training facility in Marinette. As Danielle Kading reports, residents are still no closer to a permanent source of safe drinking water.
Kayla Furton sits on the porch of her childhood home in Peshtigo, just offshore a drive overlooking Green Bay. The property has been in her family for decades, and to her, it's more than just a house.
It's the history, the land we grew up on. It's been so fun swimming in the bay with the kids. And the playhouse that we have is the same playhouse I played in growing up.
The mother of three bought the home from her parents when she moved back to the area with her husband, Dean, in 2016. In 2018, they learned their home is one of many affected by PFAS contamination from Tyco's facility in Marinette.
I fear that we don't even know the full extent of the impact on the community and really especially on the kids.
The chemicals have been linked to serious health issues, including kidney cancer, fertility issues, and thyroid disease. Furton was diagnosed with thyroid disease a year after they moved back. She can't say for sure that it's due to the contamination. Her family has been drinking bottled water for years now. PFAS has seeped into so many parts of their lives that they even give their pet chickens filtered water.
They get very loud. They want us to bring their scraps out.
Research has shown a link between PFAS concentrations in hens' drinking water and the levels detected in eggs. Furton, who's also a town supervisor, says it just highlights the multiple paths of exposure.
It shouldn't be a normal part of life that the water coming into your home isn't safe.
Peshtigo was the first of many communities in the state to deal with pollution from the so-called forever chemicals.
And we haven't even sampled
That's Peshtigo resident and former hydrogeologist Jeff Lamont. He points out most communities haven't tested for PFAS even at the state's request. Once they do, he thinks the number affected by the chemicals will only grow. Lamont pours a glass of water from his Culligan water dispenser. For the last 3 years, he's been drinking bottled water and using a filtration system paid for by Tyco and its parent company, Johnson Controls. They've been willing to fund extension of a water line from the city of Marinette to the town.
The fault for not getting extension to water, I would have to put with the town of Peshtigo.
He says town officials kept kicking the can down the road. Still, Johnson Controls Chief Sustainability Officer Katie McGinty says it's the best option.
This time next year, we could have clean water flowing through a new municipal water line.
But it's not as simple as putting pipes in the ground. Building a water line would require annexing the town to the city. Not all Peshtigo residents were thrilled with the idea because they would likely face higher taxes and more regulation. Now the Marinette City Council has passed a resolution against extending water to the town. Before the vote, Marinette Mayor Steve Genesot said questions remained over who would bear the responsibility and cost to own, operate, and maintain the water line.
We've got our own separate issues that the city is dealing with this contamination issue.
Peshtigo's newly elected town chair, Cindy Boyle, says the move was unexpected and disappointing.
I think the more options that you have, the better, but we have other options.
Those include going to the city of Peshtigo for water. Whatever the solution, Christine Haig with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says Tyco still has to identify how far the contamination goes and who needs clean water.
We don't believe that we have the answers to those questions yet.
Tyco and Johnson Controls dispute that, and they're eager to move discussions forward about a permanent water source for residents. So is Kayla Furton.
If we focus on the positive outcome, which is clean water for everyone, I think we'll get there.
She just doesn't know how much longer they'll have to wait. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we continue the conversation about PFAS and travel to Rhinelander, where the city's water system has had PFAS in some wells. We're going to talk about some creative ways they're trying to both evaluate and fix the problem there. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had this concern in your community, whether it's one of the ones we've talked about so far or one we haven't? Let us know how it has affected your life. What questions do you have about PFAS contamination? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Chris Fredrickson is mayor of Rhinelander. Mayor Fredrickson, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, well, I appreciate it.
And James Tingem is director of the Geological Engineering Program and an associate professor at UW-Madison. Jim, welcome to the show.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be on.
And Mayor Fredrickson, let's start with you. When did you first learn about a problem with a concern of PFAS in water in Rhinelander?
We did voluntary testing in March, which we got the results later on in the year of 2019, I believe. When it popped for PFAS, or when we got those first set of results, within a day or two, we shut the wells down, or actually the well. We started out with well 7. It took a while to get to well 8.
You still have enough water supply without PFAS contamination. It sounds like this is affecting a couple particular wells in your community.
Correct. Actually, it's about 25% of our water supply. That being the case, we are getting by the skin of our teeth. There are a couple of issues that, as you discuss and learn more about PFAS, as to whether or not a new well would even benefit us, or if the plume is already larger than that. Also knowing the fact that as aquifers, as I've learned, travel or move, this chemical is a forever chemical. The best thing to do is to remediate it or pull it from the water source through filtration, as far as I understand at this point.
And Jim, Mayor Fredrickson just mentioned tracking how contaminated water moves, and that's part of where you come in. What kind of things are you doing in Rhinelander to try to figure out how this water is moving under the surface?
Sure. Well, Mayor Fredrickson indicated that they had PFAS in well 7. That was 590 parts per trillion. That's well over the Wisconsin recommended enforcement standard of 40 parts per trillion for that particular compound. Well, if that is in that well, it has to come from somewhere. And so what my research team is doing is trying to scope out the three-dimensional image of the subsurface in the area of those wells so we can hopefully understand where the PFAS is coming from, how it's getting to those wells and other potentially impacted areas.
Can you talk a little bit about the technology here, Jim? I've heard it described as radar, but sort of pointed down instead of pointed up, you know, like we think of looking for airplanes. Can you tell us a little more about what you're doing to image what's under Rhinelander?
Yeah, so my research team was up there 2 weeks ago in the vicinity of those wells, and we were indeed using ground-penetrating radar, which the airport uses and weather stations use. Instead of pointing the radar up, we point it down, and that electromagnetic signal, subsurface, such as the groundwater table, layers of clay, or the bedrock surface.
And Mayor Frederickson, I understand you reached out to UW-Madison and Jim, and you're looking for other insight. What kind of things are you doing to reach out and try to bring in people to figure out how to track this and how to fix it?
Once I found out we had a problem with it, I did my due diligence in looking at other areas that have researched it and what they've done in the past to learn from Alpha Deltas and their projects. We reached out to the southern part of Michigan and asking how they dealt with some of the removal of this. Because the next part of it is being ubiquitous chemicals. How do we destroy it or get rid of it? And whether it's bad just out there or is it bad in consumption? What are the issues so we can drill down the most cost-effective and best way to eliminate the health risks from it? That being the case, we watch what Peshtigo's done, what French Island's doing, what Woodbury's doing, and tried to learn from those things to decipher how we can get to the best solution for our future. And that's the fix it. So we've taken an approach of no blame, no fault. We're just moving forward with every resource available to us in the city to fix this problem. That being the consideration, the best way I can see to allow that to happen is a competitive resource. And what we have as a resource is we have the area that we have a known contaminant. We know approximately what was in the wells prior. So to study it as the aquifer goes on and allow engineers and scientists, such as the research team from UW, to actually really, really digest this material and put it out there for cost-effective ways and best ways to fix it. Basically you give wings to the people that can fly and let them fly.
And Jim, once we have good maps and know how the water is flowing and what, you know, where the contaminants are coming from and going, how are you hoping that can start to point us towards solutions?
Yeah. So our phase of investigation right now is the pathways for that contaminant transport. You know, once we understand those pathways, then we can look at a range of drinking water solutions. That might include remediation, as Mayor Frederickson indicated, whether that is a groundwater pump and treat, a reactive barrier wall, thermal incineration. We can look at that as possible solutions to destroy or collect the compounds. Also, very much looking at how we can protect the wellhead protection or a zone around the wells so that we ensure those sources of PFAS don't make it to the well. And, you know, ultimately we may have to abandon those wells and consider putting other sources of drinking water supply for the city in other locations.
We're talking about PFAS contamination in groundwater right now in Rhinelander and efforts to understand and fix the problem there and beyond. Our guests are Chris Frederickson, mayor of Rhinelander, and Professor James Tingem, director of the Geological Engineering Program at UW-Madison. He's been doing research in, I guess, really under Rhinelander. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this problem, PFAS contamination of drinking water, a problem in your community? Are you in one of the places that you're drinking bottled water instead of the groundwater? Are you worried about what's going on in your community? What questions do you have for our guests? Are you a local leader in part of the state that's dealing with the same issue they're talking about now in Rhinelander? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Rhinelander Mayor Chris Fredrickson and Jay Tingem, Director of the UW-Madison Geological Engineering Program, talking about an innovative project in Rhinelander to map the city's subsurface and learn more about why there are elevated levels of PFAS in the water that feeds a couple of the wells in that city. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a local concern about PFAS contamination in your community, a question for our guests. If you're part of an effort to tackle that problem, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jim, I know with some pollutants, it very much matters what kind of topography and geology you have under the surface. Is something we learned in Rhinelander going to necessarily apply in another community with PFAS problems?
Yes, that is definitely what we're hoping to provide, that pathway on these techniques. So like if you're in Eau Claire and you have very similar sandy and gravel subsurface, you might learn from Rhinelander, French Island and La Crosse, also a very sandy terrain. So we're hoping to apply these techniques for the general use across Wisconsin and beyond. You know, really that Wisconsin idea where we take our research to the boundaries of the state and beyond. Rhinelander is up near that northern boundary of the state and just a great place to be doing this research.
And Mayor Fredrickson, you mentioned that you've reached out to leaders in other communities that were already dealing with this problem. Is this becoming common enough that you feel like there's a good shared body of knowledge out there for a local leader in your position?
I'll tell you the truth, it's on the map. It's being talked about. Now getting some action moving forward, both with our legislation. The governor put $10 million in. It was scratched for a fix-it plan that was a little bit different. As I play politics, one of the things is I'm not a politician. I truly represent my people. So moving towards that fix as fast and as amicable as we can is the ideal condition, and that's what we work for. I believe it has that steam. Then again, I've also been pressed into the issue deeper than most at this point. But I also hope to offer those solutions to the new partners that come to the table afterwards, and they can learn from us and also have a good product out there to put clean water availability to their residents, to their people.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Natalie is with us in Menominee, Michigan. Natalie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Natalie?
Well, I heard you say a moment ago that, at least you were wondering if people were drinking bottled water instead of perhaps their municipal supply or whatever was available to them. And I just want to tell you that when I researched this because of the threat to the water, the Menominee River water, I wrote to about 10 bottled water companies. Two of them wrote me back and said no. And I asked them, are you testing your water for PFAS? Is your water you bottle and sell to us PFAS free? Eight of them didn't reply. Two of them said, we don't test for that. The only people that said they did anything with PFAS was Culligan said, we can set you up with a service that will filter it out. But, you know, just like if you buy or if you in the lobby of where you work or whatever, you see a bubbler from Culligan water, that's not PFAS-free.
Natalie, thanks for the call. I don't know, Jim, have you looked into this, whether we can treat our water at the household level and if we're testing for PFAS in the water we buy? What do you know about that, if anything?
Yes, well, first, one of the problems is we don't have an in-force groundwater standard in Wisconsin yet. It has not been legislatively acted upon. You know, so we really don't even know what the target levels are for what we would consider safe drinkable water. So with that said, I'd have an abundance of caution. And if you're source of water potentially has PFAS in it or does have PFAS in it, I do recommend some form of filtered or treated water at your house, bottled water. And I'm really not familiar with what the companies out there providing bottled water are doing quite yet, a little bit outside of my range, but I would hope that that all is coming so that we know what is in our water, because I really believe citizens, we should have clean water, clean air, clean energy, and the like as fundamental rights. And, you know, we're leading that battle in trying to provide it at Rhinelander and other cities across Wisconsin and the upper Midwest.
Natalie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Mayor Fredrickson, as I understand it, your residents in Rhinelander are not at the point where they're having to get outside water, bottled water, right? You've shut down the affected wells. Your other wells at this point are still drinkable.
Yes, correct. We shut down the wells. We tested. It was monthly at first and then bi-monthly. And I don't know if we moved to quarterly because the numbers have not changed, but we might be on bi-monthly. We're going to move to quarterly to continue to ensure the safety of that water. The testing is expensive. And personally, if you wanted to, Northland Lakes in Crandon does do home testing for PFAS. Now, the collection of the PFAS sample is a little bit tricky. I believe the DNR has an accepted collection policy on that, and you can get that from their website. At least that's from discussions, some of the things that we've learned, because we will look to collect other samples also around our affected area soon.
And Jim, do you want to see someone, I don't know, the EPA at the national level or somebody in the state level give firmer guidelines on what's an acceptable level of PFAS? You mentioned a recommended maximum in Wisconsin.
Yes, that would definitely help the engineering community, cities such as Rhinelander, in understanding what their target is. So do we need to put in a granular activated carbon filtration train? And, you know, also not just for public wells, but for private wells. You know, so Rhinelander area has lots of private wells that are likely not being tested. You know, I will note that at Crescent Spring, which is over a mile from the Rhinelander domestic wells, they are also getting high hits of PFHXS. The same compound in the city wells is over a mile away at another spring. So really need to move forward and just understand what's happening here in Rhinelander and other impacted communities.
Mayor Fredrickson, what would you like to see, if anything, from the state or federal governments to help communities like yours deal with this?
I would like a first them to buy into the philosophy that we're working on. The DNR and a lot of the places work based on a perceived responsible party, establishing, you know, who's responsible to do what and in what time. I'd really like to move past that and get to just the point where we're fixing it. There's a fair amount of engineering companies out there. We put out an RFQ for our wells 7 and 8 was basically a request for qualifications to understand what engineering companies have technologies to work with on this. As those are developing, I'd like to see us use well 7 and 8 to constantly test the emerging technologies. So as it gets cheaper, as it gets more advanced, as we can drive that number down to even get it down to zero. Now, Wisconsin hasn't come up with a number. The EPA came up with 70, but I believe Europe's down to like 2 in a lot of its places. So obviously the progression may happen. So let's figure out one with bait and transport, which is what Dr. Tinsham really works on. How long, how much, and what we can expect to filter for these things. And then using new technologies, using that commerce of competitive nature between the engineering firms and the students and the education places to compete to fix it. There's a lot of brilliant minds already working on this.
And Jim, briefly, in just half a minute, what is the biggest open question you want an answer for when it comes to PFAS?
Funding is going to come from, hopefully from the Senate's infrastructure package that will help cities such as Rhinelander. With funding, we can attack and address this issue.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And Mayor Fredrickson, thanks for being with us. We've been talking to Chris Fredrickson, Mayor of Rhinelander, and James Tingem, Director of the UW-Madison Geological Engineering Program. We talked to them today about efforts to model the Rhinelander subsurface and understand PFAS contamination, how it moves around underground, and ultimately to find solutions to the problem. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, meet the Wisconsin filmmakers behind a new movie that tells the story of 2020 from COVID to racial justice protests and beyond. Get a sneak preview of the movie Trace the Line tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Next, it's news. Then we'll talk to a doctor who says the number of COVID-19 cases in the U.S. may be being inflated because of the way we test for the virus. We'll hear what he says we should be doing instead. That's coming up next. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.